What am I supposed to say?
I've never listened to a podcast.
You're listening to Big Wheel Coaching Podcast.
You're listening to Big Wheel Coaching Podcast.
A podcast. Brian McCulloch here with Big Wheel Coaching.
Hey, you're listening to Big Wheel Coaching Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Big Wheel Coaching Podcast. We are here for another exciting episode, and these are my favorite episodes. I am your host, Brian McCulloch. You probably only know that because you're probably a faithful listener, and I hope that you are, because we certainly love bringing this content to everyone. So thank you for joining us. I'm Brian McCulloch. I am the assistant to the boss being the big wheel herself, my lovely wife, Joy McCulloch, and I'm here today with my man, Eric Andrejo. Eric, it's so excited to be here and share some of your stories here from some recent cool gravel races, man.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I'm excited to be here and excited to talk about some gravel.
Love it. I love it. So for those of you at home, obviously the last few weeks have been a lot of gravel heavy stuff, but you know, I've been working with Eric for, well, geez, Eric, how long have we been? We've been working together, what, like 8-ish months, somewhere around there?
Yeah, since kind of the end of last season, maybe August last year, something like that.
Oh yeah. We're coming up on a year here, man. This is great. Well, there's going to be a coach athlete anniversary here in the future. I like it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. A year goes by fast when you're training hard.
That's it. Well, you know. So for those of you at home, you know, like I said, it's been a gravel specific kind of couple of weeks here, but, Eric and I have been working together for 8-9 months now. And I just have to say, I'm so impressed with all the work that he's done, and he's made so much progress. So, Eric and I got connected through Training Peaks, and we got connected there, just before the, Mammoth Grand Fondo last year. And in fact, kind of come to find out, we ended up seeing each other like in the middle of the ride in the Mammoth Grand Fondo last year. And that was really cool. I think you were riding your Holland then, one of the bikes in your stable of your fleet. And, since then it's been a whole lot of gravel and a lot of road training to prepare for gravel. And what's been really cool is just 2 weeks ago and really leading this week, you have a really big ride called the Jackson Forest Grasshopper Adventure Series race. And you just finished your biggest ride of the year, and really kind of your goal of the season, which was Lost and Found Gravel. Well, I guess I shouldn't call it Lost and Found Gravel. It's just the Lost and Found ride up in the Davis Lake area, right, Eric? Where is it exactly? It's in the Sierras.
Yeah, it's in the Sierras. It's just north of Truckee. It's kind of tucked away in a little town called Portola. And it's really cool because the event kind of takes over the town. I mean, it's a little bit kind of like what I imagine the DK to be, where the whole town is really about the event for the weekend. And there's just hundreds and hundreds of cyclists, people camping everywhere within the town, and then a big ride on Saturday, and then a whole festival for the weekend in the town.
Dude, that's so cool. I didn't realize that there was a whole festival. We were just so focused on your preparation and how you were going to pace and nutrition. I didn't even think about all the festival and all the other kind of excitement that goes around the event. What was some of that stuff?
Well, that was cool because actually my family came with me. So we had an RV from a friend of mine. We went all the way up there. It was a beautiful drive there. Kind of you get up into the Sierras and then you go north a little bit into these high plains. It was really cool because there was a kids race. My daughter actually, she was a little nervous, but she ultimately ended up doing the kids race, and she had a fun experience doing that. And so I guess the history of this event is because I was chatting with one of the guys who was kind of an old timer. Is people just used to go camping at Lake Davis, and then they would just go riding, kind of as part of the camping trip. And it just grew and grew year over year to be a big kind of, you know, proper race event, that it's become today.
Well, it's kind of a big deal, right? I mean, it's really, for the West Coast, it's probably one of the biggest events that, as far as like in difficulty and challenge and lore and excitement, it definitely has a whole lot of people. A lot of people are really, really interested in that event for a lot of reasons, but I think a lot of it has to do with that, like you said, that whole, we're taking over the town, we're having a good time, it's cyclists everywhere, and there's a whole cool vibe besides the fact that the course is extremely difficult. I mean, tell us a little bit about it, right? Because it's not as if it's just like, okay, cool, I'm just going to go do 100 miles. This is a pretty unique situation. There was a lot of really challenging sectors of this, besides the fact that the whole course was probably a very difficult course, but there were some actually very, very challenging sectors of it. What was the course like? Let's set the table for us, dude. How long is it? What's the story there? And what brought you to be like, man, this epic event is my deal. I want to be a part of that.
Well, for me, this was kind of a big event. I mean, first of all, it's in the Sierras. I don't live in that part of the world, so it's kind of remote. It's got that whole self-sufficiency aspect, which was a big appeal. It was really the first 100 miles for me on gravel. The course ended up being 106 miles. It's got more than 8,000 feet of climbing. It's almost entirely gravel from kind of start to end, with the exception of a little bit of pavement at the very end coming back into town. And the terrain was just extremely, extremely varied. Everything from there's snow, there's water kind of on the course, crossing the course, a whole bunch of different types of surface conditions, sand, rock, going through forests, corrugated kind of like forest service roads, all kinds of different gravel, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of climbing, and it's all at elevation. Which is just another whole dimension for a regular guy like me.
Well, when you say elevation, I think it's important to tell people like it was like 7,000 feet, right?
Oh yeah. So I mean, it was, we've had a huge amount of snow this year, so it's been kind of an issue with a lot of the events that have been taking place in the Sierras. So the town of Portola itself is about 4,000 to 5,000 feet. And then the event starts with a big climb right out of town. So you immediately go from, let's call it 4,500 feet all the way up to 6,000-7,000 feet. And then you climb a little bit higher later on in the course. And by the time you're up there, this is the first gravel event I've actually ridden on snow before. And in fact, the course.
Probably a lot of people have that first there, buddy. A lot of people are riding in the snow in NorCal right now.
Yeah, and you know, they tweak kind of the course. They actually modify the course to come off a ridge a little bit. I mean, we still ended up going pretty high, but we didn't go as high as was originally planned on the course because there was just too much snow. And so my wheels did touch some snow, but I didn't spend a lot of time in snow. It was fun. It was fun in any case.
That's pretty rad, man. Well, not just did you have an incredible ride there, but obviously you brought your family, your daughter had the event. That was really cool. I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about your buildup to that, because it's obviously, it went, you know, spoiler alert for everyone at home, it went really well. You crushed it. You finished super strong. We're going to get into some of the specifics about that, but it was really how you built up to it that I thought was really interesting. And one of the things that I've been so proud of you for as a coach is you rode a lot of events and a lot of different events that were, number one, they were motivating to you. Number two, they helped you test yourself against yourself, but also test yourself against others and a whole different array of other people. Sometimes it was your peers. Sometimes it's people that were, had more experience than you. And sometimes it was around people that had less experience for you. And I thought that was really important for you as an athlete to go through all of those experiences, so you kind of know all you can about yourself. So when you go into a self-supported event like Lost and Found, you can use all of those experiences to know, okay, I can go this hard right now. Or that way you could have the most robust kind of tool bag of experience to draw upon when you're confronted by a new experience, like I've never ridden on snow, or this is just the most fatigued I've ever been going into a ride, or now I'm confronted with these, you know, this very rugged terrain that I'm trying to navigate on essentially a fully rigid bike, not essentially, exactly a fully rigid bike. That can be very, very challenging. So for you, let's talk a little bit about that buildup and what that took to get there, because there was a lot of road miles, there was some group riding, there was other gravel events. Kind of what experiences did you feel like along the way made the biggest impact for you at Lost and Found? What events were those and what experiences were they like?
Yeah, I kind of drew on my whole kind of cycling history a little bit, and really a lot of focused practice, if you will, in doing a bunch of events leading up to Lost and Found. So I'm not really kind of an athlete by background. I mean, I did a really tiny bit of road racing when I was in college. I mostly have done bicycle touring, and that's kind of, I think, where I got the gravel bug. Is in doing bicycle touring, especially self-supported bicycle touring in remote places. Like, I've done touring in Bolivia and Mongolia, and all the roads are unpaved there. You don't see a lot of cars or a lot of anything really, except for beautiful landscapes. So that my base was kind of really around being self-sufficient, and I felt very comfortable being on the bike for a long time, not necessarily going fast, but being able to kind of get from point A to point B, and felt pretty comfortable being on rough terrain. But I knew that I really didn't have any experience doing that in an environment where I'm trying to go fast, where I'm trying to compete. And so there's a lot of small details that I learned through doing a bunch of events. And the way I like to think about it is I essentially, every event I did, I made some new mistake. And then that was one less mistake that I can make the next event. And I probably did, I don't know how many events this season leading up to Lost and Found.
It was over 10. It was over 10. Yeah, it was
something like
you
that.
You were doing at least two a month, and this was the beginning of June. So, I mean, and if we take the late fall and winter ones you did, yeah, you were at least it was 10. You were doing. Yeah. And you started very early. So something I didn't know, though, let's like back the truck up for a minute there, buddy. You did bicycle touring in Bolivia. And what was the second place? You said Honduras, or where was the second place?
The most remote place I've ever done is Mongolia, in the southern part of Mongolia.
Wow. I did not know that. Holy smokes. Okay. So like, I'm going to guess that everybody listening at home, although they're very performance based and want to be their best, I can just about guarantee that nobody listening has like ridden a bicycle in Mongolia or Bolivia. So we got to stop right there, and you got to tell us a little bit about that, because this is pretty cool stuff. Like, A, how did you even decide to go do that? And what kind of bike would you even ride over there? I mean, what do you do? Like, there's no bike shop there if you have a problem. Like, I guarantee they don't have Dura-Ace 11-speed chains over there. I'm sure of that.
No. You got to be really self-sufficient doing something like that. Well, I kind of grew up in cycling doing self-supported touring. I did a bunch in the U.S., Pacific Coast, Northeast, kind of Northern Tier, all over the U.S. And then I started to venture outside the U.S., and then eventually I got more and more off-road doing touring. Like my longest tour, I did 6 months in Europe, kind of everywhere. Had some of my best days actually on the bike during that trip, in terms of kind of feeling strong and being able to kind of finish the day strong. But then I started to do more off-road touring. One of my favorite ones was, like I mentioned, Bolivia. I had a hardtail mountain bike. I mean, I basically had beginner's mind doing all these things. I just thought, oh, it'd be cool to ride my bike there. I'll put some bags on my bike, some panniers. I'll just go there, and I would put my bike in a box. I would fly there. I would assemble my bike in the airport, and I just start riding. And I had usually
riding
some sense
from the airport. You just got on your bike from the airport, and like, no Uber, no like taxi to the hotel, like, or to the remote location. You just like ride away, like, see you later.
Yeah, that's usually what I did. I mean, you kind of pull your bike off out of the box, and you're sitting in the corner of the airport terminal with some wrenches, and you kind of get it assembled. You get your wheels back on, you get your handlebars back on, you make sure everything's still good, you pack it up, and then you just start riding. That's how I usually did it.
Okay. Like, what do you travel with? Okay. So, again, I'm used to traveling, like, for when I'm racing for Elevate KHS Pro Cycling, it's like, you know, I travel with my bike, and then we have, you know, I have a bag with like my carry-on stuff. You know, it's got like my shoes and my helmet and a kit in it, just in case anything gets lost, I can ride any bike that we have, but like all my stuff's in my carry-on. And it's like, but then there's so much that our mechanics and our soigneurs and all this stuff bring for us to do, right? Like, there's just so much stuff to bring. Like, there's no way you could just come into the airport, unbox it all, and I could ride away with it. I mean, there's just no way. What are you putting in your bags to be able to do this? And I know we're getting off on a tangent, but I'm just fascinated by this. This is like, you brought everything you have basically, and then you leave the airport with it all on your body or on your bike. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. Well, you have a cardboard box that you kind of leave at the airport. And then you hope you can find another one, or sometimes you stash at the airport and you like pick it up on the way out. There's various ways to do that. Your carry-on is a front pannier or a rear pannier. That's your carry-on. The rest of your panniers, you already have packed with all your kit, and then you just put them in a big like duffel bag. Actually, you had like an army surplus bag that would be out of canvas. I would just pack all my panniers in that, in my helmet and my shoes and stuff. And so that's outside the panniers, which you're going to carry anyways. You just have that one additional bag, which is useful. You can kind of use it to strap stuff on your rear rack or something like that. So yeah, you literally have just everything with you. And I found that was a lot easier than trying to, you bring a bunch of extra stuff and then you have to like figure out how to get it all to the hotel. And you're in a country where you at least I don't speak the language. So trying to like navigate from the airport to the hotel with a big bike box and a bunch of other stuff. And you know, I'm traveling by myself anyway, so I got to carry everything through the airport, which is, you don't want extra stuff if you're carrying everything, you know, on your own through the airport, especially if you arrive in the middle of the night or something like that. So it's just simpler just to kind of get everything on the bike and carry things on the bike. And at that point, you might as well just start riding. Because usually the airports are usually far away from the city center anyways, and you want to get to the countryside. So it's saves some of the trip.
Wow. You are a stud. Like, I knew you were a badass before, but dude, you're a stud. That is cool. So one more quick question on that, like, from an equipment standpoint, right? Like, I kind of got brought up in the two is one is none mentality, which is like, always packing extra, right? So, you know, I'm notorious for like, I have two of everything, right? And then my teammates will come to me and they'll be like, hey, B, I don't have my rain cape and it's raining. And I'm like, cool, I brought an extra. Here you go. Or like, oh man, I crashed and ripped my gloves up. I'm like, dude, I got an extra, right? Like most of the time I have an extra. So two is one is none, right? It's an old US military adage, right? Two is one is none. I'm sure it transcends a lot longer than that. But anyway, so that would be where my head was at. But then I'd show up with like 47 duffel bags of stuff, and I wouldn't even be able to like ride out of this airport, right? So like, you obviously pared it down to only the essentials. Like, what does that essentials look like?
I wouldn't say I totally pared it down for those kinds of trips, because you are going to be on your own. You're going to be self-sufficient. So like, I would have things like spare tires, you know, in my kit bag, because if you blow a tire in the middle of nowhere, you're walking.
You're done.
You may be walking like 40 miles to find something. And you're certainly not going to find a tire like in a small town in the Gobi Desert, for example. There's just aren't any tires. So I would have a lot of stuff. I mean, my bike was easily with like full water, because I would sometimes carry 15, 20 liters of water at a time, because you don't know when you're going to find water either on occasion. So my bike could easily be 150 pounds worth of stuff on there.
Wow. Easily. 150 pounds, dude.
Yeah. All in, like, wow, all the food, all the water, all the gear. Yeah.
That's a far cry from that beautiful open bike that you're riding right now. Like, when we rode together, like, that thing's a work of art, you know, with NV wheels and tire, or, you know, NV wheels and cockpit and everything. That's a far cry from that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's one thing I had to learn, was how to kind of pare down, because you get kind of used to this self-sufficiency mindset from the background I had. And then when you go on an event like this, you know, every ounce, you don't want to be carrying off the hills. So not carrying like a pump or not carrying five CO2 cartridges or a whole bunch of food that you're not going to end up eating or a whole bunch of extra water that you may not need. That was one of the things I had to learn, in order to go a little bit faster was you gotta slim down.
Well, there's definitely been a transformation, at least from our time together last year at the Mammoth Grand Fondo, and then all the time that we've been working together as coach athlete, and then just here into, you know, we got the opportunity to ride together when you were down in Southern California for some vacation. So I would say, like, for me, as I've just been kind of privy to this portion of your life, and I didn't know you then, I look at that and go, wow, you've made such a transition in the time that we've been working together. Like, well, that's incredible to think that you were at once on a bike that was 150 pounds and carrying extra, you know, five CO2s. I can tell you that nobody listening to this is like, oh yeah, I roll around with a seat bag and five extra tubes. If they do, like, if they're not in Bolivia, they could probably drop three of them. Right. That's really fascinating. So, okay, so we're talking, you did like 10 events leading up to this, and now it makes sense to me a lot more why you chose so much more gravel and why you're really loving and embracing that adventure style of racing. But you did a lot of road stuff, and what something we did very early on together is you were training for Levi's Grand Fondo, right? King Ridge.
Yep.
And you were doing the Yenzi Fondo. Both of those are road. And obviously Mammoth Grand Fondo was also exclusively road. So you've got a lot of road stuff. And actually there's some road, you have some road goals coming up later this summer, right? And so in my mind, you used the road and really embraced that as a way forward. And being from NorCal, where it's a high population density, right? You kind of have to embrace that. I mean, obviously you want to get off road and get away from the cars from time to time, but you know, a lot of your work has either been on a trainer, out on the road, and or at these kind of like road events. So what did you take from that road mentality that is, can often be so, you know, aero focused, super light bikes, minimalist kind of stuff? You know, that's kind of one extreme to the other, which was your 150 pound bike. How did you transition through there to come into, now you're going to a self-supported ride of a totally different fashion. It's not a self-supported ride. It's a self-supported race. So every ounce matters.
Yeah. For me, it was really kind of thinking about building up some skill set and layers. So I had done a little bit of road racing before. So I had kind of a little bit of a sense for what that was like. And there's just such nice roads around here where I live and nice road events that if you want to kind of get into a groove of training and doing events, you know, roads are a great place to do it. And there's a lot of skills I found that I picked up from all the road riding that were very transferable. So things like, what do you carry with you? How do you ride in a group? How do you kind of manage a peloton? Pacing strategies, nutrition, hydration, clothing, all that, you know, very basic stuff, which probably is obvious to maybe a bunch of your listeners, but not obvious necessarily.
Hey, to regular guys. There are listeners like there, buddy. They're our listeners, buddy. Oh, okay. You're part of the Big Wheel Coaching family, bro. This isn't a gang, but we're just a crew. Like, you know, you're part of the Big Wheel Coaching family. This is all of us. So anyway, I digress. Sorry.
Yeah. So that, I mean, for me, those were kind of like basics that I could learn on the road. And then without having to layer in, you know, all the extra stuff you get with the gravel, which is just kind of complexity, if you will, on top of that. So I wanted to get some of the basics down. And the other thing that I did a lot this season, which I really recommend, if anyone has a chance to do it, is I have done, with the exception of one, every Grasshopper adventure ride, which are mixed terrain events. So this is a series that has gone back like 20 years now, and it's their events that are mostly in Sonoma County, but other places in Northern California as well. And they're mixed terrain. So there's a combination of road and gravel. It's kind of like a Belgian waffle, in a lot of ways, but there's a series of them over the season. And each time the combination is a little different. And so the bike that you would pick for one event, it could be very different than the bike you pick for another event. And kind of building up the lost and found doing these events was really my, my primary training ground to make all my mistakes, kind of learn the basics and really refine my, my approach.
I love that. I love that. You know, something that comes to my mind here is, you know, if we were to think of something like as massive as, say, an Ironman triathlon, right? There's so many layers that goes into training and preparing for an Ironman triathlon. And that would just be to do the event, let alone to race the event, then race the competitors in the event, right? So I always, whenever I talk through training with my endurance mountain bike athletes, I always kind of think there's kind of three kind of people in any event they're going to go to, right? There's people that are just racing for the first time, right? Or kind of just racing themselves, or I would say even just racing, trying to get experience. And there's a second group, a second person that's like racing themselves for a PR, right? Uh-huh. And then there's like a third person that has like done all of that. And now they're so good. They're not just racing themselves. They're racing themselves and all the other people in the event because they're going to try and, you know, win their age group or whatever that is, right? And what's been interesting in our time together is you've really transitioned from you've done some of these events that were just kind of like, okay, I need to do this for distance just to be able to say I've done it, right? But then in other events, you had like that past road racing experience and other experiences where you're like, okay, no, I'm trying to race these other people around me, right? Or we even had events where you're trying to race yourself, right? Because we kind of had some back data that we were like, okay, last time you did this, this time we want to try and achieve this. So like with Yenzi, for example, you were really racing yourself and you kind of blew it out of the water. You did super good there, right? That was a really, really good performance.
Yeah, I think I kind of built up from each of those levels to the next one and kind of the way you laid it out. I got really back into cycling after taking a break for a while when I moved back to the Bay Area. So about 10 years ago now. And I spent a lot of the beginning of that time just getting back in the bike and really just kind of being able to ride a certain distance. And I was one of those guys who was just really excited to finish the event. And like, I remember the first year I did, Levi's Grand Fondo as an example. It's probably, I don't know, 7-8 years ago now. And man, that was a hard day. And I was just proud to make it back and be able to have some paella and get back into town, for that event. What I found over time is I kind of started to build up some fitness as I really wanted to push myself and see how competitive I could be. And it's really been great working with you and your team, especially this season, the kind of transition from a finisher to more and more competitive, and then to kind of see myself slowly improve some of my tactical skills and all of the kind of technical elements, and then move up the ranks little by little as each event unfolded.
That's one thing that I thought was really exciting that I really wanted to bring out in this podcast was you've been a great student, right? Like a lot of people, when they think about getting coaching, they think, well, I just need somebody to look at my workouts and I just need somebody to like, you know, help me get stronger, right? Because the main vehicle to getting better performance is, of course, being stronger. Well, that is absolutely true. No question about it. But there's all these other things. And you alluded to it earlier when you talked about the variety of riding that takes place on the Grasshopper series. And for those people at home that are like listening and going, well, what do they mean, this Grasshopper series? Just Google grasshopperadventureseries.com. Just to be clear, there's a different thing called Grasshopper Adventures, which could find you being on a backpacking trip in Asia pretty quick. So don't do that. I did that the other day. Like, don't do that. But yeah. Grasshopper Adventure Series is a it's a series in Northern California. Like you said, it's got a 20-year history. I've done a couple of those events years ago with a friend of mine, Neil Shirley, who turned me on to them. And they're really, really cool. And so you went into this whole new approach, because it wasn't just, well, I just need to get strong. Like you said, you started kind of at a place where you were just very happy to finish some of these extremely grueling events. Because let's be real, the Levi's Grand Fondo is a very grueling event. So, you know, anybody who finishes that is like, as far as I'm concerned, my hat's off to them. That's very difficult. But you kind of transitioned across this performance timeline, if we could call it that. And you've done that in a way where you didn't just look at fitness, 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 fitness. And I was so happy that you were so coachable about that and have enjoyed that so much, because we've been talking about things like descending. We've been talking about equipment selection. You've been so good about testing things. And then the fun part of the coaching has been, okay, well, we talk about the performance side of the testing, but then we debrief about it. And then we kind of go get back after it. Right. And that's where I think for those folks listening at home who are you know, maybe setting a big goal for themselves, that's where I think those medium goals, those other events that you were using to tune up for this big event, helped you so much, because it wasn't just a fitness element that we were trying to achieve there. All the while we were testing nutrition and hydration, and we were doing things even like clothing strategies, right? Because some of those were extreme clothing or extreme temperature changes, where you would start and it'd be very, very cold. And then almost immediately you get on a climb and now you're overheating. But then, hey, everybody, surprise. Now you go in, you're now climbed a significant, you know, number of footage, right? Like maybe 2000 feet, 1000 feet. It's significantly colder up there. And now you're trying to navigate, you know, at a very cold temperature, but you've overheated and sweated a lot. So what we talked about is a lot of things like, well, how do you even deal with that? Because that's not performance related. Those things are actually inhibiting your performance, just a simple temperature change. And so that has been really fun to talk about those events from a course standpoint, from a equipment standpoint, and from how you are going to apply your strategy and learn all of these elements all the way through. So maybe talk through a little bit of that and how something like the equipment or the descending or the even the clothing considerations and how that has helped you become super successful, like when you went to Lost and Found.
That was really the huge thing that I learned doing all these Grasshopper events and some of these other events leading up to it. And everything kind of sounds, when I'm looking back on it, it sounds kind of obvious in hindsight, but it wasn't really obvious at the time. I mean, simple things like clothing, like do you wear a vest? Yeah. For example, my first Grasshopper event in January, it started at the base of a really steep climb. So it's 30 degrees, 35 degrees, you know, while you're waiting at the start. And I had my jacket on because it's cold. But 5 minutes later, when you're pushing as hard as you can up the climb, suddenly you're not cold anymore. You're starting to sweat exactly like you said. And so clothing strategies was a big one. Another big one for me was nutrition. And this was especially a challenge on, gravel. I remember another Grasshopper event I did where, I was in a big Peloton, going super, super hard, doing maybe 35 miles an hour on these paved roads that would suddenly turn to gravel and then back to pavement. When you drop from the pavement onto the gravel and suddenly you're in a dust cloud and you cannot take your hands off those handlebars, if you want to not take down the Peloton, you got to figure out how to eat. And you can't just take your hand off the bar and fish in your pocket and grab something to eat, because you could hit a patch of deep gravel and your front end could turn to the right or left on you. And you can't see anything because it's in the dust and you got five wheels in front of you anyways. So it's simple stuff like nutrition, when to eat, you know, how to put things in your pockets, stuff like that. And then all of the really kind of technical stuff, which bike do you ride? Cause every course is going to be a little different. So which bike do you ride? Which wheels do you have on your bike? Which tires are you going to pick? different tire sizes. And then, of course, what is your inflation pressure going to be on front and rear? And so there's just a million kind of little things. Each one by itself is kind of conceptually very simple, but they all combine together and create a lot of complexity, which I really like as part of the sport. I think that's one thing that really excites me about gravel is it's not just about my FTP. Like, it's great to have a big FTP, and I'd love to increase my fitness over time, but it's usually not the guy with the best FTP who wins the day in these events, in my experience. You got to do all those other things right as well.
I love that. Do you ever see that movie? What was that movie with, didn't have Brad Pitt in it? It was like Moneyball or something like that, right? Where it was like on the Oakland A's. You remember that movie?
Oh yeah. Like
did you ever
Moneyball.
See that?
You think about
Yeah.
Moneyball?
Wasn't that the one? Well, yeah. And they were talking about, I remember there was the scout and he was talking about that, talking about Brad Pitt's character. And he said, "Hey, you're one of the only five tool athletes that I've ever seen." Right. And they were kind of talking about him as a five tool athlete. And what did that mean? Right. And what they were really talking about is that he was a baseball player that could do everything, right? He could do offense and defense. He could hit and he could throw. He could field. He could do all of these things. And he was such a rare kind of diamond in the rough that he could be sculpted into this like beautiful professional MLB player. Right. And so it's really interesting. That always really stuck with me in my own racing is that I think I always admire the people that are five tool athletes, right? And that's what I've loved about working with you is that you're on that same mission. Like you are like, hey, let's figure out how to be, yes, I want to be strong, but I also want to have the best technical skills possible. I want to know how to use the hydration and nutrition strategies that are available because there's lots of great ones out there. There's not one size fits all for everybody because every event is different. Every body, human body is different. And you've been wanting to explore all of those things and become a five tool athlete. And I think that's something we always really try to express to people when we have the opportunity to work with them on a one-on-one basis is that being a five tool athlete allows you to get the most out of yourself in every situation. And as a pro cyclist myself, like I've seen like, I've had teammates over the years that can only really do well in one scenario or one set of circumstances. And if anything kind of upset that apple cart, then everything is derailed and the performance is what could have been. Right. And I just, as a coach, that hurts me because I want to see all of my athletes do as well as possible. I know all of us at Big Wheel Coaching, like we just want to see everyone do the best they can and setbacks happen. And so something that I've been really proud of you for is just that dedication to being a five tool athlete. I don't think we've ever really talked about it in that fashion, but it's been clear from the beginning. I mean, geez, E, you've been like, you've just always wanted to talk about, we spend a lot of our time talking about equipment, talking about tires, talking about how the terrain we're going to make certain, we're going to make certain concessions to your strategy based on the equipment we're going to choose. For example, like you talked about, am I going to run a faster setup? And I think we should really talk about that because you learn some things by running. I mean, you have a specialized Venge, which is not considered an off-road bike by any means at all, but you even rode it in some of what I would call the lighter off-road events. And you rode really, really well with that. So maybe let's talk about, it's not just all about having robust equipment. I mean, you've gone from this guy that was riding a 150-pound bike in Bolivia, right, to like you have a specialized Venge with disc brakes. I mean, that's like, you know, that's got all the bells and whistles that to go fast, right? But you even put that in an off-road scenario and were very successful with it.
Yeah, that bike in particular, I rode an event called Fish Rock, which is another event I highly, highly recommend. That was a fun day. It's like freezing rain the whole day, 6 hours, 10,000 feet of climbing, 70, 80 miles. But that's an example where kind of in a mixed terrain event, you could be in a road race for the first half of the event. Like Fish Rock is a perfect example like this. It starts out as a road race. So it's all paved, a lot of climbing, but it's a road race. So you're going to be in a Peloton, you're going to be doing fast ascents, you're going to be going over some rolling terrain. It could be windy. So aerodynamics is going to be a huge issue. And then, oh, by the way, you know, the last half of it, you're going to go on a really steep dirt climb. You're going to go up and down this dirt road. And then you finish back kind of at the start line back in the town. So how do you pick a bike that's going to do well on both of those? And what inevitably happens is you got the wrong bike for at least one part or frequently more than one part of the course. So what I did is I took my Venge. I took my normal wheel set, but I put on a slightly larger tire. I could fit 30s on there. So I put 30s on there. And then I said, oh, well, I'm going to replace my cassette. So I was running on my Venge 42 in the back. I think I was running like a 42.11 for that mm-hmm. event. With a Durace derailleur, I mean, in theory, that's something possible, but it works if you use the Wolf Road Link setup. And that worked great. So I was able to be kind of aero, stick in the Peloton. I could descend fast, corner well. And then when I got to the 25% dirt climb at the end, I could get up that thing too. Now that setup wasn't awesome for the off-road descents that were in that course. Maybe I could have had a slightly bigger tire. I mean, maybe next year I'll have a slightly different setup. But you always got to just kind of think about, at least in the way I think about it, is there's unfolding dynamics in the course over time related to the road, the wind, traction, pacing, and then what everyone else is doing, of course. And you just have to pick the equipment that's going to allow you to have the range of options that you need to execute whatever strategy you want to have as the day unfolds.
Oh, yeah. And I think what you said there was so key. That's the wisdom. We got the gem that you said was, you said at some point in the day, you're going to have the absolute wrong bike, right? Like at some point, you're going to have the worst bike setup. But there's an opposite of that. You're going to at some point have the best bike setup too. Right. And that's what this kind of whole gravel thing has been really exciting, is that people, you have to make a choice and you have to make a compromise. Right. And so what we've spent a lot of time talking about is, well, can, when you are in the situation where you have the worst bike for the situation. So let's just say you're riding up a dirt climb that's really soft dirt and you have 30C tires. That's pretty narrow and you're going to want something a little more voluminous. Right. I would say that, how are you attacking that? And we spent a lot of time talking about, okay, like when the bike is set up like this, here's going to be how you need to ride to be successful, right? And then by the same token, we did, okay, well, now that the bike is set up like this, right? And so, okay, in these cases, you're riding on the dirt, or I mean on the road, and you have the preferred bike for that situation. How are you riding? And so it's been really cool to build that around your unique strengths as you've been progressing as an athlete, i.e. been able to ride more aggressively. You've had more strength. You've been more savvy within a group of people, whether that was two people or five people or 25 people or 50 people, right? So I think that has been a lot of fun to work through that together. And I think it's worth you coming back to that and saying, well, okay, what was that like? Because sometimes you're riding, like you said, you're riding a Venge in a group of people that maybe have more strength or maybe at a higher category than you, but they're riding a more gravel setup. So now all of a sudden you're kind of like, you know, you're playing with some big boys and you're able to ride, and that was very beneficial for you. But then you've also been in situations where you've had a very robust bike that's helped you when other people have been on very light duty bikes, is what I would say. And you've been able to kind of pass them because you had a more experience on the dirt. So maybe talk a little bit about that balance.
It's really, I try to kind of build my skill set so I can compensate for whatever, either, I guess, let me put it this way. I can compensate when there are shortcomings, or I can double down when there are comparative advantages. So let's just say I'm on a bike that's kind of under undertuned in terms of tire volume for technical gravel. Well, what I try to do, and this is something that we've been working on together, is I just need to build my technical skills, because you can go down a technical descent on gravel on 30C tires.
Absolutely. Now,
you don't have suspension. So when there's something in front of you, you got to either go around it, you got to bunny hop it. You can't just hit it and, you know, hope for the best, because you're going to be on the ground if that happens. And so you, in a situation like that, you just have to compensate for what you do have by having better technical skills on a descent. So that's been one example of that. I think on the flip side is when you have a comparative advantage, let's say you're on the flats and you've got an aero road bike and you're next to some people who've got maybe higher front ends or a little less aero. They've got maybe bigger tires and a lot more rolling resistance. Well, that's a great time to bridge up to a group in front. Because you're going to be able to translate power into speed much more efficiently than maybe other people around you at that time. And so I try to take advantage of that. If I'm in a position where if the terrain is suited for my fitness, my bike is suited for the terrain and the conditions right now, that's the chance to kind of put in some efforts, and turn those efforts into better pricing or more speed.
That's great. That's really good advice, E. That's really good advice. Cause it was, I think we even talked about it from both sides, right? Where we talked about it as, let's just say you are on a great bike, that you said had a comparative advantage, right, of the others. That could even be, that doesn't necessarily mean you need to smash all over everybody. Sometimes we did that and we tested it to where you would conserve energy in those situations so that you could spend it in other more challenging or technical areas of the race. So some of the events that you did building up, they finished with very, very technical or very, very difficult single tracks or something like that. And what we had talked about was using your equipment in those scenarios to maybe conserve some energy so that you had it to spend later. So it wasn't always that you, when you had a comparative advantage, that you kind of, you know, unrolled the carpet, as you said, and you've emptied the tank. This was more like you've used it both ways. You've used it to unroll the carpet and kind of inflict your will on folks, but you've also done it the other way, where you've used it to conserve energy so that you could then come out and then tackle some of these more technical and challenging areas of the course at the end of the ride with some energy to spare, right?
Yeah, that works too. I mean, it's all about kind of, I think, thinking carefully about the strategy for the event. And then, of course, the more of these events I've done, the better I've gotten at putting together a strategy. And then mapping that strategy onto the course as the course unfolds and the dynamics play out.
That's been a lot of fun to do that together, for sure. What you've done, so many different events, and you've obviously come, like we talked about, you come from riding in Mongolia and getting out of an airport and building the bike to, you know, riding some very technical places on a very light, racy bike. What would you say, like, what's that transit? What are some of the events that you think are must do's for people that you've done? Cause you built yourself up a stable of events that you've done, and some of them you've done for multiples of years. What do you think for those folks in Northern California or in California or even on the West Coast? What are the kind of events that you think people should do and why?
That's a really good question. I mean, it really, to me, depends on what your goals are. But, if you want to kind of get exposed to some diversity and kind of build up more breadth, I think an event like Levi's Gran Fondo is a great event. There's so many riders. So there's so many different skill levels. You can always find a group that's going to be a good match for your skill. And it's really challenging. There's challenging climbs. There's a technical element. You can add a little bit of gravel to it if you want to. You don't need to. The terrain is very varied. There's just a lot of things to consider about pacing, over the course of the day. So that would be one I would definitely think about. If you really want to challenge yourself, there's some really hard events, which I've done this season. there's one grasshopper event in particular. This is Super Skags that basically broke me. That one is, so think about it as like it's a road race, a really hard road race with a single track enduro race tacked onto the end of it. So you do a road race in Sonoma County, which also includes a pretty hard technical off-road descent, a lot of climbing. And then at the total end of the day, after you've been on the bike for 6 hours, five, 6 hours, then you do a really hard single track around Lake Sonoma. So that one, if you really want a challenge, is a great one. Actually, the woman who won that one, the Super Skags event, was Amity. Who then went on to win DK. So there's something to be said for that, I think. And then the other one I'll put kind of in that category. I would definitely recommend all the grasshopper events. And then Fish Rock, which I talked about a little bit, is a pretty crazy hard mixed terrain race that's in Mendocino County up by Ukiah that is really, really good as a challenge as well. So I highly recommend that one. And then if you want kind of more of just an experience and you like especially the community aspect, I think some of the gravel grinders are really interesting. Lost and Found, I would put up very highly in that list. I mean, it's just a great event overall, and you can treat it as a race and go very hard. Or you can just treat it as a fun weekend, you know, with the family as well.
That's great, man. That's really cool, Brett, that you've done all of those different events. What would you say? You've got some events coming up that you're pretty excited about too, right? I mean, before we get to that, something I need to say is you talked about Super Skags breaking you. And I think we have to really dissect that really quick for everybody, is that it wasn't like we've kind of painted the picture that you had like this amazing buildup and you had no flaws. And we tested every scenario and we found that, boof, here's like, you know, here's your Cinderella slipper. And then you put the Cinderella slipper on and you went and smashed it, Lost and Found. And that's really not the way it was. You've had some challenges and you've had some setbacks. You know, Super Skags was kind of a big, tough day for you, right? And that was really the biggest ride you've done. I think even to date, that was like really big. I mean, even compared to Lost and Found, I'm not looking at the data in front of me. I'm going off my memory, but that was such a difficult and challenging ride. But again, you just came back. You're so coachable. You came back and you're like, okay, what can we learn from this? And that's where I think you grew so much more even out of that, right? We had to adjust the training quite a bit to help get you rested after that, because that was such a big tax on the system, even bigger than we had accounted for. We knew it would be big, right? But it just turned out to be even more challenging than we thought, more taxing than we thought. So let's talk a little bit about that, because I think you came back from that stronger and you learned more from that one scenario than maybe we're leading on to.
Yeah, that was an example where I had an opportunity to make some mistakes and then not make them again. I mean, because that was a really big day for me. That I think that's my only 600 TSS day I've ever had.
Oh, yeah.
And I was doing, in that event, I was doing really well in the road race part, the first part. I was with the Peloton. I did the first cool climb. It's not an easy climb. It was Sweetwater Springs Road Climb, kind of a famous climb in Sonoma County. I did that with the Peloton. I got like my max 20-minute power, I think, during that climb.
Yes.
So it was a good day. And I was pretty strong. If I had just finished and done, there's a road version of that event, which is just called, Skags, which a lot of people did. I think I would have done pretty well. But by the time I kind of got to the single track, I was dehydrated, was I think my biggest mistake. It was kind of one of the first warm days of the season. And so I wasn't managing my hydration appropriately. And I kind of entered the single track pretty exhausted and pretty dehydrated. And then there was a really just technical section of single track, a lot of steep climbs. And that was another example where you know, pacing was probably off. I went too hard in the beginning. I got a little too carried away with the group, and mm-hmm. paid for it in a big way later. And equipment was wrong. My tires were for that, single track. I kind of underestimated the technical complexity of it. And the tires I had were just not the right tires for that section of the course. Probably gearing could have been adjusted as well. Like I've since then, for some events I have coming up, I've swapped my 44 in the front of my 1x gravel bike, the open, for a 40. So for those types of steep climbs. So it's just a bunch of learning experiences, but it was great that I went so deep. I mean, I was in a dark place on that single track. But I've finished it. I'm glad for all the lessons I learned. I'm certainly not going to forget them. Cause I'll always be able to go back and remember where I was. And so now I know I can, even if I'm that deep, I can still finish. And, I know how to better avoid getting into that situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The lessons learned there were profound and they stick a lot longer. Right. And I just wanted to make sure that everyone kind of heard that from you, because so often we think that, you know, if we're in failure, it's like, okay, let's just like sweep it behind us and let's just keep moving forward because, you know, we don't want to dwell on it. Right. But there was the lessons learned there are sometimes the most powerful ones. And what I loved about what you took from that is that I can go this deep, which is extremely powerful for all of us as athletes, is to remember to see that, like, as humans, we are really, really powerful. We can do so much. And so even when you think that you're smashed, like, you can go further, you can do more. Now, I'm not saying it's going to look prettier and it's going to feel good. I can actually guarantee you it's not. But the fact is that you can keep going. So number one, people are better than they think they are. And that folds right into my coaching philosophy and the way we think here at Big Wheel Coaching. But the fact that you learned those lessons and you found that, hey, not only like was this really difficult, but you rose to the occasion and found a way to be successful and and by successful, I mean finishing, right? Like, it was very easy. You could have pulled out. A lot of people around you did, by the way, right? A lot of people pulled out and you didn't. You kept going so that you would finish, even though you were in that dark place. So I think for you, I'm not advocating that everyone needs to have that experience by any stretch, but there is one thing to be said about being an endurance athlete, that if you push the limits long enough, you're going to have a scenario like this. And I'm just so proud of you for showing your mettle and being like, hey, like, you might be able to beat me, but I ain't quitting. Like, I won't quit. And so I was just really, really proud of you for that. I think that was a great learning experience. We learned a lot from it together, but you bounced back from that. And that was only a couple of weeks out from Lost and Found, came back, crushed Lost and Found, and finished awesome, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it kind of reminds me of one trick. I don't know what you think about this, Brian, but when I was in that dark place in Super Skag, I was thinking about when I was in the Gobi Desert, and there was a 3-day stint when I was in the Gobi Desert when I didn't really have great maps and I thought I was kind of lost. And I remember I just kept going forward and forward and getting more and more worried about being able to make it out of there, essentially. And there was at one point I was pushing my bike through sand for like 6-12 hours at a time.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I took some rope and I rigged up this harness so I could drag my bike through sand, and then I could then pedal my bike for 50 feet and there'd be more sand. So if you really want to kind of test yourself, and develop resilience, at least this has worked for me, is if you just kind of go a little further out than you should be, and you got to get back to stay alive. It's one way to do it. Cause then after that, you'll be able to draw on that experience. And that was going through my head, at that time, is I was thinking, at least it's not as bad as when I was in the Gobi Desert.
Okay, well, there's the quote of the podcast. I think that's the quote of like every podcast thus far, right? It's not as bad as when I was in the Gobi Desert, you know? Quotes by Eric Andrejo. At least it wasn't as bad as when I was in the Gobi Desert with a 50-foot, you know, when I'm dragging my bike through sand, you know, for 3 days. Oh, man. Well, that's wow. Well, I don't know how to close this out any way better than that. Just okay for everyone at home. When it just gets bad, just think at least you're not in the Gobi Desert, right? It's
like, it can always be worse. And the other, okay. I mean, the other thing to think about is you chose to put yourself there. I mean, it was all voluntary, so there's no one to blame but yourself, and it could always be worse. So those are some of my tricks, mental tricks. Results may vary.
Okay, on a much lighter note, we got to talk about one more thing, and we joked about this when you and I went riding together. You have a pretty ridiculous man beard that is just like next level cool, and this is coming from a guy that I can't grow facial hair if, like, you know, for anything, for whatever reason. And so I joked with you and I was like, oh man, like, hey, you get the gravel beard going on, like, cause that's the cool hipster thing to do. Cause that's like, what, you know, the gravel folks, that's kind of their signature stitch possibly. And, you came up with a great quote and I think you got to share it with everybody. So like, you know, here's your forum, dude, you got the floor.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've had a beard before it was cool and I'm probably going to have one after it's cool. Maybe that makes me the ultimate hipster. I don't know. But had I known the beers were such a thing in gravel, maybe I would have done something else. It certainly wasn't my intent.
No way, man. You're a man of the times. Like, now you're doing it. Like, now you got the look and you're a pioneer. You're a pioneer in the Gobi Desert, and now you're a pioneer here in the gravel scene in NorCal. Dude, I love it.
Yeah, I guess if you say so. At some point, I'll just be an old codger. Yeah, that's what I think, if I'm lucky.
There you go. All right, well, I think your Gobi Desert comment is a great way to talk about closing gratuity. And we always, it's just something that I always want to bring to this. And I know it's a very unrefined portion of our podcast, but I think that thankfulness and gratuity is something that is so important and should be practiced regularly in our day. Cause we are there's so much to be thankful for. And, since you're not in the Gobi Desert and you're not walking endlessly for 3 days thinking you're probably lost, what might you be thankful for, E?
Well, I'm really thankful for all the support I have, especially for my family. They're very supportive of kind of following me on this journey. So I'm really, really thankful for that. And I'm really thankful for your help, Brian. It's been amazing working together, and it's been kind of amazing and exciting to be on this journey together.
Well, that's a nice compliment. Thank you. Thank you very much. Like, you know, Eric, I just think the world of you. I'm super proud of you. And I've really enjoyed this. You know, I do love my job, and I do love being able to meet great people that are really pushing the limits. And so I'm thankful. I'm thankful for a lot of things, but I'm thankful that this podcast happened today, because, you know, we talk a lot. I mean, we talk pretty regularly, and we communicate pretty regularly. And in all of our time together, I never knew that you did bike packing. And maybe even if you did, I never knew that it was in Mongolia and Bolivia, and that you would get off the plane and just like, boom, build up your bike and hopefully stash this box and it'll be back when I get back, or be there when I get back. Like, man, I am really thankful that you shared that story. Cause I think that's like, I don't know, a lot of people that would like kind of be willing to do that. I mean, I'm a pretty adventurous guy, I think. And I'm always up for kind of doing some kooky stuff, but that's next level, man. So thank you for sharing that story and being so open with that. That's really cool, man. I really appreciate that.
It's been great. It's been great chatting with you. And never underestimate kind of the power of beginner's mind. When you don't know what you don't know, you'll do all kinds of crazy things.
The beginner's mind, you don't know what you don't know. Well, good, buddy. Well, I think you're far beyond that. You've done super good, and the best is yet to come. And so any closing thoughts there?
No, I think we covered everything. I mean, I got a few more events coming up for the rest of the season, so I'm excited to keep moving on the journey.
Good. Well, this time I'm going to hold you to this. You got to get some photos of this. You go to all these cool places. And we're just itching to show some of them on our social media, dude. So, like, you know, I'm going to put you to this. You got to get some dang photos.
All right. I'll do that. I'll stop and smell the roses and take a few more photos.
Okay.
Thank you so much, E. You are just awesome. I really appreciate your time today. And thank you for being with us for another great episode of the Big Wheel Coaching Podcast, Eric. You're awesome. Really thankful to all the folks at home and all the people listening. This is such a labor of love. We enjoy sharing these athlete stories and people that are building and being successful. We love being a part of their journey, and hope that the folks listening at home can learn something from you in this experience and all that they can take into their journey so they can continue to be successful. So thank you to everyone for listening, and we'll look forward to catching you guys on the very next episode of the Big Wheel Coaching Podcast. Make it a great day.